I want to name that this service has been very much inspired by beloved member Helen Millian, who passed away a number of weeks ago. That Carol spoke about her. She was pretty loud and proud about her participation in 12 steps. And I was always grateful because it can be a complicated theological walk for UUs to go into 12-step groups. And she was someone I always trusted to help folks navigate that journey. About 100 years ago or so, there was a particularly bright and book-minded son of a miner. Miner, M-I-N-E-R, not M-I-N-O-R, miner, named George Gordon. Family lived in New England, and George's dream was to enroll at Harvard. But not only did his family not have the money for tuition, but George actually had to quit high school because his family needed him to work. But George was a voracious reader and was just as learned, if not more so, than those who had completed formal schooling. And George convinced the powers to be to allow him to enroll as a special student, auditing but not receiving credit for classes. One semester he was studying Greek, and like there is in classes, there was a midterm. So he showed up that day of the midterm with his fellow students and with a blue book in hand. I don't know if, do they still do blue books? Or is it like a blue screen? Upon seeing George with his blue book, the professor of the class pulled him aside and said, George, you don't need to take the exam because you're a special student. Oh, but I want to take it, George said. Well, as a special student, you're technically not allowed to. You're not getting credit, so you don't need to take it. And George responded, Professor, you make me feel like an idiot. What am I not even worth being examined? Finally, the professor relented and allowed George to take the exam. And reflecting on this experience, George Gordon wrote, the meaning of human existence is to live in a community where there are standards, where there is judgment. For if you do not live in a community where there is a shared sense of judgment, then you are not on the way to becoming human. This was a favorite story that UU minister and theologian James Luther Adams liked to tell his ministry students. Many people who are drawn to Unitarian Universalism are attracted because of our openness. But James Luther Adams liked to share this story of George Gordon because as important as freedom and openness is to our tradition, it is not by any means the entirety of the UU tradition. Adams would write, to many people, the attraction of religious liberalism has been its openness, its tolerance, and its freedom. But unchecked, precisely these qualities can produce the mind that is simply open at both ends. Adams is widely regarded as the most important Unitarian Universalist theologian of the 20th century, and he championed themes that tend not to be our most favorite, themes of conversion and guilt, sacrifice and discipline, conflict and tragedy. Without these, Adams believed liberal religion becomes complacent, accommodating cultural trends that distort truly liberal values when resistance is called for. Conversion, discipline, sacrifice, conflict, guilt, tragedy. Yep, definitely not number one on my list of favorites. But Adams focused on these themes because as a young new Unitarian minister, he had gone to Germany in 1935 to study with some of the greatest liberal theologians of the time. And it was there that he confronted the deeply unsettling fact that Germany's most liberal churches were not effectively resisting the rise of Nazism. Adams was a convert to Unitarianism from Baptist fundamentalism, and he had high expectations for Germany's long tradition of liberal religion, a tradition that very, very much informed the inception of Unitarianism in this country. But again, liberalism was not seeming to offer adequate resources for resistance against the Nazi threat. And Adams came to admire the German Christian Confessing Church movement, whose members were more actively opposing Hitler at great personal risk. Now, I imagine you might be asking at this point, what the heck does any of this have to do with the 12 steps? Here's the thing about openness. When you are secure in your life, secure in yourself, your livelihood, in community, in your government, in the state, openness is great. But what about when things fall apart? When the things you have most trusted betray you? When you see yourself behaving in ways you don't want to but yet cannot stop? When pain just overwhelms you? When your world crumbles, you need something to hold on to. When we are raised to the bone of our resilience, you want something solid and clear, not necessarily something that requires lots of your own thinking, discernment, and decision making. Frankly, when your world falls apart, I don't know if you really want to hear question, debate, and criticize. What I want is something I can trust to hold on to. And the many people I've witnessed wrestle with addictions of a variety of sorts and find the 12-step community to be useful, if not life-saving, this is what I think is going on. 12-step communities assume that something in your life, if not your entire life, is falling apart. It assumes you are experiencing pain you find unmanageable and says unequivocally, yep, join the club, been there, done that too. You are not alone, not unique. And here are some very concrete things to do, perhaps should do, that have worked for a bunch of people. Ultimately, it's the person's decision to do these things, to show up, do the steps, and many people do not. And because 12-step groups don't track their success and failure rates, it's difficult to kind of do any kind of statistical assessment. I think we can say that 12-step groups have been very important for a lot of people, and something about them works for at least some significant group of people. And fortunately, there's more and more ways being figured out for those who need something different. Because I think as you use, we would say that there should be more than one way. But perhaps you have witnessed something like what author Susan Cheever witnessed with her father. Quote, my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was when my father went. He didn't want to. He had been to meetings and didn't like them, blah, 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 and finally went through a long process. I'm not going to tell you all the stories. He went to rehab, and he came out a different person. When he went into rehab, he was just this sour person, was ready to die. He just sat around criticizing all the time. You could just tell he was miserable, and so he made everyone else miserable. He came out of rehab and started to going to AA meetings, and he became a completely different person. He was totally engaged with the world. He suddenly wanted to learn how to use the dishwasher so that he could take care of himself. He was funny, he was empathetic, he was concerned. He was involved in other people's lives. I mean, my father had a change of heart that blew us all away. And that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a big, big deal when people stop drinking and have that change of heart. I too have witnessed this kind of change in heart in some people, not everyone. And it is nothing short of miraculous to see someone so captured by pain and their attempts to deal with it find some degree of freedom. Because addiction is about pain and the very normal human reaction to it and our ways to try to stop it. Addiction is about our brain's neurochemical proclivities to seek what gives us pleasure and avoid what gives us pain. I think addiction, though, to be honest, is also about profit-seeking exploitative industries that seek to exploit these human proclivities, that seek to push short-term profit-creating solutions over longer-term, not-so-money-making solutions. Over 50% of Americans have one or more close relatives with a drinking problem. If you were to expand this to include drugs and other kinds of addictions, I think we could easily say that everyone has struggled with addiction or has someone very close to them who has struggled with addiction. That addiction is an epidemic, and our culture says that people right now are overwhelmed with pain. And of course, it's not just random who is overwhelmed with pain. I think, for example, about how Native and Indigenous people in this country are 3 times more likely to be alcoholic than the rest of the population. A people who have been genocided, colonized, and oppressed sure do have a lot of overwhelming pain to deal with. Basil Braveheart, a Lakota teacher and healer at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, has been in 12-step recovery for 3 decades. Like a nearly a third of Native children in his generation, he was sent to a Catholic boarding school, part of a long-standing federal policy whose goal was to eradicate Native culture and religion. He has since reclaimed his Lakota heritage and spiritual practices and uses them in tandem with 12 steps to help others recover from addictions. Braveheart went to war at age 17, the Korean War, and he says, "When I came back, I used alcohol to cover up the pain that I experienced as a combat veteran. There was a particular incident that happened in an island off Korea called Jido, which was a Chinese prison camp. We went in there, and we did some things that only the shadow, the dark side of us that can surface to do the things we did, and to later laugh about it and drink beer. When I came back, I had no idea. When I had all those nightmares and intrusive thoughts about this prison camp, I had no idea that was one of the things that so wounded my soul." When Braveheart works with folks struggling with alcohol and drug addiction, he always thinks about it as a person's soul having been wounded in some profound way. I think of that, in the language of soul doesn't work for me, what I hear is the language of trauma, how one's psyche, one's basic integrity and relationality can get so damaged in an overwhelming way. And this can happen in a war zone, and it can happen in our homes. It does happen in our homes. When pain overwhelms you, when your world crumbles, we don't just need openness. We need a community where there are standards and practices that help carry us when we struggle to carry ourselves. In the words of writer Maria Popova, "In every life, there comes a time when we are raised to the bone of our resilience by losses beyond our control. Lacerations of the heart that feel barely bearable, that leave us bereft of solid ground. What then? What then?" Hopefully a community that has both openness and firmness, boundaries and compassion, curiosity and commitment. I hope that our Unitarian Universalism produces minds that are not simply open at both ends, but rather produce hearts, bodies, and beings that offer practice, practices and relationships that allow us to grasp the wisdom and theologian Reinhold Niebuhr's prayer that has become so central in 12-step communities. Please grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Blessed be, and amen.
This is a time for offering. The offering that we take each Sunday isn't just a stale habit.